Today is Tuesday, May 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Iraqi forces push Islamic State in a battle for control of Fallujah. Hundreds of migrants drown in separate incidents on the Mediterranean.
The contest is a challenge to teams from around the world to develop software.
A five-year competition aims to help disadvantaged children to learn. Also ahead, music and dance from India, centuries old in a new performance. It's all on today's International Edition. Iraqi forces have entered the Islamic State-held western city of Fallujah following a week of preparations by tightening their grip on territory surrounding the city, taken by the Islamic State group more than 2 years ago. The Iraqi commander is quoted as saying the combined force of counterterrorism service units, Anbar police and Iraqi army regulars is backed by tanks, artillery and airstrikes. On Friday, U.S. Defense spokesman Colonel Steve Warren in Baghdad said Iraqi forces are moving on multiple axes and trying to limit civilian casualties in the assault.
We estimate there to be up to 50,000 citizens remaining in Fallujah. They've dropped leaflets to inform the civilian population to avoid ISIL areas. Those leaflets directed those who cannot leave to put white sheets on their roofs to mark their locations. The Iraqi army is working hard to establish evacuation routes, and the local Anbar government has set up camps for displaced civilians. It's still early in the Fallujah fight, so it's unclear how long this battle will last. We've seen two flavors of ISIL in the last several months. In Ramadi, we encountered an enemy that chose to stand and fight. More recently, in Heat and in Rutba, ISIL hid behind women and children before throwing down their weapons and running away. In both cases, they lost, but one was quicker than the other.
Warren said the Islamic State group is under pressure elsewhere, with U.S.-backed Kurdish forces launching an offensive to retake area around a key road, while Syrian Democratic Forces undertake operations to liberate the countryside north of the Islamic State de facto capital of Raqqa. Ambassador James Jeffrey, who served in Baghdad and is now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Iraqi forces have serious challenges in the offensive to retake Fallujah.
Fallujah's a tough nut to crack. There's still somewhere between 30 and 50,000 residents of the city in there. They've been traditionally more pro-Al-Qaeda than anybody else in Iraq, and thus some of them might be fighting with ISIS. Secondly, the very presence of civilians about the dangers of using mass firepower, and you really have to use mass firepower against ISIS. So those are going to be problems. Again, the question is whether they will fight to the bitter end in Fallujah as they did in Ramadi, and they have more troops there. They have between 500 and a couple of thousand. This campaign in both the Syrian, basically it's three separate campaigns. It's the Syrian campaign pushing down from the north towards Raqqa. It's the campaign in Anbar that we just talked about, with Fallujah the main front right now. And then it's a campaign in the north to isolate Mosul. Nobody's ready to go into Mosul yet, but we are isolating it. But basically, this campaign is now much better coordinated, and it's obvious that the president has given his U.S. military commanders far more latitude to put the pressure on ISIS. And the attacks on its oil infrastructure and thus money, its attacks on its leadership, its cutting of communications is now finally beginning to show results.
Are the Peshmerga up to putting this pressure on Mosul eventually to retake it, and how long do you think that'll take?
Kurdish forces are not going to venture very far outside largely Kurdish areas without a lot of U.S. support, more than just some special forces teams. Because if American troops are on the ground, they basically sort of reassure everybody, at least in the short run, that another ethnic force isn't going to take over and ethnically cleanse you and stuff. And that's part of the reason for the Kurds. But the Kurds also don't want to have their troops die for territory they then have to turn over to somebody else. Some of the areas where the Kurds are moving forward are areas that have traditionally been under their control or contain a high percent of Kurds. For that matter, East Mosul was traditionally a significant Kurdish area where the Kurdish Peshmerga always had, up until 2014, a significant security presence. So they could be capable of doing East Mosul. But East Mosul was never the center of Al-Qaeda, and it isn't the center of ISIS. That's West Mosul. That's the bulk of the city, and that's where the real fighting is going to be.
James Jeffrey says while momentum has shifted away from the Islamic State in both Iraq and Syria, experience shows that the fight to retake Fallujah, Mosul, and Raqqa could be either quick or long. Meanwhile, Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren believes the liberation of Fallujah, whenever it comes, will help ease the security situation in Baghdad by reducing deadly Islamic State bombing attacks there. Well, for our social media segment, we now turn to domestic politics here in the United States. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio to bring us what's buzzing online. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. We talked about hashtag Bernie Trump debate just a few days ago, but it seems like that plan is no more. Democratic presidential contender Bernie Sanders and the presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump were widely expected to debate in California before the June 7th primary.
And what happened?
Well, Trump bailed out, basically. He argued the Democratic nominating contest is rigged, and Sanders' rival, whom he named Crooked, Clinton will not let him win. He added that in that case, it would be inappropriate for him to debate the second-place finisher.
Well, that's interesting. What's the reaction like on Twitter?
Hashtag Chicken Trump has replaced hashtag Bernie Trump debate. And one of the most liked tweet using that hashtag is from a well-known celebrity. Comedian slash actor Sarah Silverman tweeted, "You wussy Donald Trump. You are afraid to debate Bernie Sanders? You should be. Hashtag Chicken Trump." More than 15,000 people liked that tweet. Silverman is an American stand-up comedian who addresses taboos and controversial topics in her acts. She's on Twitter at Sarah K. Silverman and has more than 8 million followers.
Wow, that's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. What are the contenders saying about it?
Not too much on social media, although they're mentioning the presidential race, of course. Trump sent out a not-so-subtle attack on Clinton in an apparent bid to solidify his argument on the fact that she and not Sanders will be the Democratic nominee. He tweeted, "I would have had millions of votes more in the primaries than Crooked Hillary if I only had one opponent instead of 16. Broke record." Sanders, for his part, wrote, "If you want a campaign that can defeat Trump and defeat him badly, we are that campaign." Jim, back to you.
Well, obviously, the season is not over yet. Thanks
Never
so much
a dull
for that.
Moment.
No, not at all. Thanks for that wrap-up, G. You may tweet your questions and comments to our International Edition stream. That's found at VOA_IE. And if you like, tag myself and G on those tweets. We're at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Here are some of the stories that we're following in Asia at this hour. Reports say North Korea is preparing for a missile launch. Taliban kills around 57 Afghan forces. Bomb blast in Pakistan targets Chinese engineer. China's education reforms spark protest. China blocks UN resolution to curb lead in paint. Now, you'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Hundreds are feared drowned in recent days in rickety boats operated by smugglers from Libya headed toward Europe. The United Nations says as many as 700 men, women, and children may have been lost in at least three shipwrecks on the Mediterranean last week in the worst tragedy of its kind in more than a year. In Sicily, Giovanna Benedetto of the humanitarian group Save the Children describes the disasters and rescues by the Italian Navy.
This week probably was one of the worst weeks in the last years, because arrived at least 30,000 people. They were rescued from Italian Coast Guard, Italian Navy, and Navy of other European countries. And they arrived not only in Sicily, also in other regions in Italy. Only in 1 week, at least 30,000 people. And there were at least 3 shipwrecks, maybe more. We don't know exactly. We have to understand, because the people of the survivor of the shipwrecks were rescued from a lot of ship and arrived in different ports from West Africa and East Africa, Somalia, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and also from Nigeria, Ivory Coast, Gambia, Mali, Senegal, this kind of countries. They lived terrible, terrible situation. They told us terrible story.
Giovanna Benedetto of Save the Children. She's based in Sicily. Well, we're about to hear of a performance, centuries old, Indian music and dance. But first, a 5-year competition is challenging teams to develop software that will enable children with limited access to learning materials to be able to teach themselves basic reading, writing, and arithmetic. The nonprofit organization XPRIZE, that designs and manages public competitions, has launched the Innovation Project in a partnership with UNESCO. That, of course, is the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, along with the World Food Program. Matt Keller is the senior director of the $15 million Global Learning XPRIZE, and he tells International Edition's Lori London that he's just returned from Tanzania, which will be the host country for the competition.
The contest is a challenge to teams from around the world to develop software that's designed to bring children from zero literacy to literacy in reading, writing, and math on their own and with each other in 18 months. So what we want to do is to challenge teams to think differently about how kids learn. Is there really a self-learning component in kids that could actually exponentially increase the number of teachers in the world, each kid being a teacher? So that's what this is all about.
And you've got some pretty big news regarding the contest and the prize money.
Well, that's right. The prize money is put up by Elon Musk. Elon Musk has put up the entire $15 million prize purse, and we announced that we have partners on the ground in Tanzania with the United Nations, which is UNESCO, the education branch of the UN, and the United Nations World Food Program, which is the logistics arm of the UN. And in addition, that Google will be donating 8,000 Pixel C tablets to be used in the field test, where we'll give these to kids in 200 villages, 4,000 children, and test whether or not this software, this kind of dynamic learning environment, can take root.
And you say villages. Where specifically are you targeting, trying to help which kids where?
Sure. We're targeting villages in Tanzania, where Swahili is the mother tongue. Teams will be developing software and content in both Swahili and English. That content and code will be open sourced, and then once the top 5 teams are chosen, we will put those top 5 solutions into the field and test them in Tanzania among that population of 4,000 kids. So it's a big, you know, huge field test, testing the supposition that kids can actually teach themselves and each other how to do these basic competencies.
Has anything like this ever been done before?
Nothing like this has ever been done at this kind of scale before, and I think a lot of people are watching this, you know, folks at the World Bank, at the UN, at different multilateral institutions are seeing if this works. And if it works, if you can actually prove that kids on their own can bring themselves to some state of literacy, it's a big deal. I think you can prove that technology is a really, you know, big tool that you can use to reach the kids who are hardest to reach.
What is the time frame for this contest?
The teams will submit. Right now we have 135 teams from 33 countries around the world, and they will submit their solutions this November. A panel of judges will go through those submissions and pick the top 5, and then that will be determined sometime in April or May of 17. And those top 5 teams will receive each $1 million for being, you know, finalists. And then those teams will be required to open source their content and code. And then we put those into the field August 1st of 17 for an 18-month trial period. So it's a long runway, but it's necessary, because you can imagine the work we need to do in Tanzania, and then as well as with getting down to the top 5 teams.
And lots of incentive.
Lots of incentive, yeah. You know, it's funny. We met a lot of these teams, and they're incredibly eclectic, this wildly eclectic mix of teams, from neuroscientists who have spent their whole careers thinking about and writing about and studying the reading brain, to coders in Nairobi, to, you know, grandmothers in Ireland, to artists in Amsterdam. I mean, these are people from around the world. And when we ask them why they're competing, they never say it's the $15 million prize purse first. They never say that. They say that they want to be part of something bigger. They want to be part of something that serves as a solution to this challenge. And it's pretty cool, actually. It's pretty cool to see.
What will your reaction be when these kids get these tablets in their hands?
Well, you know, most of these kids, if not all of them, will probably never have seen a tablet. And, you know, that moment of discovery when they touch it and it comes on and it speaks to them in their language and it begins to guide them through a learning process, I think that moment of discovery will be, an electric one. Watching them develop an understanding for what is in their hands, you know, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be incredible.
Matt Keller, Senior Director of the $15 million Global Learning X Prize. You can visit voanews.com for more on our stories and follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. And while you're online, why don't you like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Natana is a volunteer group performing traditional art forms, smoothly integrating innovation and tradition. This ensemble celebrated Asian Pacific American Heritage Month with an original dance drama here in Washington. It was based on a centuries-old Indian music and dance. VOA's June So caught up with some of the artists at the show, including the director of Nutana, Rishi Das.
Nutana means innovation in Sanskrit. I named it Nutana because we can be an ensemble that performs Indian classical music and Indian classical dance without changing the original. But in Nutana's case, we try to integrate what we see around us. We try to do it in a unique way so that it still fits that traditional Indian classical storytelling, with that layer of ballet, modern African drums, Middle Eastern drums, trying to tie cultural arts from all over the world together. Our members have roots in India, many of them. Also, we welcome members from all over the world. We are a 100% volunteer-driven nonprofit organization. But I've seen that with that volunteer spirit, that real pure passion comes. Most of the members have day jobs or are students or PhD programs. I'm actually a technology consultant.
I am a dentist. This instrument is called a tabla. It's an Indian instrument. I started learning when I was about 6 or 7. It's a very unique instrument because it needs very precise pressure and the touch from your hands. So a lot of the sounds come from different types of fingering techniques. That's what interests me the most. Nutana is a pretty amazing, very talented group. I've played with many groups in the past. The artists, the vocalists, the musicians, the dancers are extremely talented. They've been through a lot of study. They've learned many, many years of music, and that's what makes it amazing.
I work for non-profit organizations in cultural policy. I've been dancing since I was six, and I've been training in classical South Indian dance called Bharatanatyam. I really find dance to be something that's very enriching. It's something that's very enriching to be another person or to express other emotions or to engage with other people in that way. Is it really brings about different experiences into one's life.
I thought the show was amazing. It was beautiful. I haven't seen much Indian dance and music in Washington, D.C. area, so I was very excited to see that here tonight.
My ultimate goal with Nutana is that we are able to nourish the D.C. area with not just Indian culture, but a modern representation of it.
Great to hear from Rishi Das, director of Nutana. That report, by the way, written and produced by VOA's Jun So. Thank you so much. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. Come back when you can, and have a super day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Vital blood service for millions of Ethiopians will improve thanks to a new cooperative effort between the United States and Ethiopia. Ethiopian Minister of Health, Dr. Ketesa Birhan Admasu, and USAID Ethiopia Mission Director Dennis Weller recently led a groundbreaking ceremony in Addis Ababa to kick off construction for the National Blood Transfusion Service Center. The new center will provide the Ministry of Health with additional capacity to receive donations, screen and process blood products, and distribute life-saving products to serve approximately 26 million Ethiopians. The 5,300 square meter facility will house the administrative headquarters for blood transfusion services, providing a permanent home for offices, training, meetings, and document storage. One of the primary reasons for strengthening and expanding blood transfusion services in Ethiopia is to reduce the prevalence of HIV in the blood supply. The new center will enable the staff to properly screen blood for HIV and other infections after it is collected. Speaking at the event, Mr. Weller said, a key reason for improving blood transfusion services in Ethiopia is to reduce the number of maternal deaths. Hemorrhaging continues to be one of the leading causes of maternal mortality in Ethiopia, and many of these deaths can be prevented through blood transfusions. Mr. Weller commended the Ministry of Health's contributions to the many months of planning, design, and the beginning of the construction of the new National Blood Transfusion Service Center. The capacity of this facility will enable the ministry to meet more than 25% of the World Health Organization's recommended annual blood collection goals for Ethiopia. Additionally, the center will oversee the distribution of blood products, which will expand access to blood transfusion services throughout rural and urban areas of Ethiopia. The $5 million construction cost is funded by the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. USAID is expected to complete construction of the facility in 2 years. The United States is proud to work with its longtime partner, Ethiopia, to help improve this and other health services for the people of Ethiopia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.